Welcome to Pulp and Paper Radio International, the first place to hear the latest in worldwide pulp and paper news. We are coming to you from Duluth, Georgia, in the United States.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Monday, March 31st, 2014 edition of NIPS by Pulp and Paper Radio International. I am your host, Jim Thompson, the voice of the worldwide pulp and paper industry. As always, your suggestions are welcome. You can email me anytime at jthompson@taii.com with PPRI in the subject line. Stay around after the show, that is after the closing, to hear me read one of the classic columns from NIP Impressions. These are being read from Raising EBITDA, The Lessons of NIP Impressions. This will be after the show closing, so don't forget to stay around. And by the way, we almost got out of March without mentioning that Pulp and Paper Radio International is 2 years old this month. Thank you for your continuing support. Leading off today, Resolute Forest Products, Inc. announced on Thursday that a $105 million U.S. dollar upgrade is in store for its Calhoun, Tennessee pulp and paper mill, including the installation of a modern continuous pulp digester and other wood processing equipment. And in another story making headlines in the U.S. last week, Packaging Corporation of America announced it will not convert the idle number 2 paper machine at its DeRidder, Louisiana mill to produce containerboard. We'll have more on these stories when we get to the North American news later in the show. We'll be back after this message.
Fulton Systems is North America's leader in terms of thermocompressor and steam systems installations. Our references in the paper industry includes over 80 years of support, thousands of operating thermocompressors, and hundreds of paper machine rebuilds. Additionally, we provide dryer section performance audits, steam and condensate system design, and consulting services. Give us a call at 770-447-1400 or visit our website at www.fultonsystems.com.
And let's take a look at last week's financial news from the PM40. We'll go to Dr. Travis Hale in Golden, Colorado, as we usually do. What's the situation, Travis?
The PM40 closed Friday, March 28th at 33.15, down 0.5% from the previous Friday. Over the trading week, declining shares outpaced gainers by a 5-4 margin. The RIDEX Equal Weight S&P 500 Exchange Traded Fund lost 0.7%. Among PM40 shares, the week's biggest winner was Domtar, up 8%. The biggest loser was Capstone, down 12%. Verso was the top performer over the last year, up 107%. The deepest decliner over the last 52 weeks has been Rayonier, down 24%. The RIDEX S&P tracker is up 23%, while the PM40 gained 30% over the last year. Have a great week, everybody!
Thanks, Travis. We'll be back after these messages.
RMR Mechanical is a merit shop contractor whose principals have over 100 years combined experience. Licensed in 19 states, RMR Mechanical works with process industries and utilities with special expertise in boiler maintenance and repair. Simply put, RMR Mechanical provides the best value to ensure your money is effectively spent. We perform as planned. For more information, call 770-205-9646 or visit www.rmrmechanical.com. We look forward to helping you succeed.
Mike Ryan of Process Labs knows rotary kilns and recosticizing. Located in Chillicothe, Ohio, USA, Process Labs has decades of experience and their services are in demand around the world. You can find them online at www.processlaboratories.com or call them at 1-740-775-5520. That's 1-740-775-5520.
And we're back, and here's the news. Starting with Oceania, Dateline Tasmania, in an update to a story we've been following on Pulp and Paper Radio International, local news outlets are reporting that receivers are expecting 7 bids to be made for the failed timber company Gunn's assets by today, March 31st. The assets, including the Bell Bay pulp mill permit and site and 96,850 hectares of hardware and softwood plantations, went on sale in November. Today is the deadline for final bids. Court of Memphis spokesman Michael Smith expected all of the seven parties involved in the due diligence stage to make a final bid. He added that not all bids will include offers for the pulp mill permit and site. It's expected to take up to another 2 to 3 months to finalize the sale process and determine if the pulp mill permit and site will be sold. Smith said receivers would assess the offers and choose a preferred bidder to continue negotiations. The identity of the potential buyers will reportedly remain confidential with Corte Mentha, only saying there was interest from Asia-Pacific region, Europe, and the Americas. Last month, legislation to quash any legal challenges of the validity of the pulp mill permits was passed by the Parliament. Dateline Indonesia, media outlets are reporting that Asia Pulp and Paper is calling on paper customers to adopt a zero deforestation policy and thoroughly examine the practices of suppliers when sourcing their paper. APP Director of Sustainability and Stakeholder Engagement Ida Greenberry says industry and government in both Australia and Indonesia need to come together and commit to eradicating deforestation. Greenberry said the company wants to focus on the future instead of the past and that it can't save the Indonesian rainforest all by itself. She says if other companies continue to log native rainforests, the erosion of drainage means even the best managed forest will be at risk. Now on to Asia, Dateline Myanmar. The Bangkok Post is reporting that Myanmar will ban the export of logs starting this week, hoping that the ban will reduce deforestation and boost its wood-based industry by exporting only value-added products. According to a statement from the Myanmar Timber Enterprise, and the Ministry of Environment, Conservation and Forestry will prohibit the export of logs as of April 1. The most recent official statistics report that Myanmar's forest cover reduced from 57.9% in 1990 to 47.6% in 2005. Dateline India, the Press Trust of India reported last week that three people, including an owner of a board and paper facility in Sanganer, died this past Monday when they fell in a tank of pulp after losing consciousness due to suspected toxic gas during an inspection. The deceased were identified as the owner and two workers. Due to suffocation, the three fell into the tank and were found dead when the responders reached the facility in the afternoon, officials said. The incident is under investigation. The facility had reportedly been closed for some time, and the three had gone to examine the machines and materials when the mishap occurred, officials said. Now on to South America, Dateline Uruguay. Sor Enzo and Arauco's pulp mill in Uruguay, Montes de la Plata, is ready to begin production, El Paz Uruguay reports. Back in the autumn of 2013, the startup of the mill was delayed until the first quarter of 2014. Now the mill is in final testing stages. This is the second major pulp mill after the opening in 2007 of the Botnia, now UPM mill in Fray Bentos. The total investment was reported at more than $2 billion U.S. dollars, the biggest ever made by a private company in Uruguay. At full production, the mill will produce 1.3 million metric tons of pulp per year. The UPM mill is currently producing 1.1 million metric tons annually. Dateline Chile. Chile's board manufacturer, Macisa S.A., has reached an agreement with the U.S. Hancock Natural Resource Group for the sale of forestry assets located in the Chilean regions of Valdivia and Temuco. The transaction could be concluded in the next 60 days, and the total price is reported at over $200 million U.S. dollars. The deal includes Macisa's assets comprising a total of 62,000 hectares, from which 32,500 hectares are planted in forests, mainly pine. A new company will be formed, of which 80% of the overall shares will be attributed to Hancock and 20% to Macisa. Hancock Timber Resources, based in Boston, Massachusetts, USA, develops and manages globally diversified timberland portfolios for public and corporate pension plans. As of December 2013, Hancock's assets under management total $11.4 billion U.S. dollars. The assets are located in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Brazil. Mm-hmm. Now on to Europe, Dateline Helsinki. In supplier news, Valmet will supply SCA with a new compact cooking G2 plant for its pulp and paper mill in Obbola, Sweden. The startup of the cooking plant is planned for October 2015. In other supplier news, paper manufacturer Paper Fabrik August Kohler SA in Oberkirch, Germany has chosen Voith to rebuild the press and dryer section of its PM5. The Kohler Group produces paper and wood pulp board at four locations in Germany. The company generates sales of 725 million euros, producing more than 5,000 metric tons of paper annually and employs around 1,700 workers. We'll be back after these messages.
Do you need to maximize your mixing capabilities? Philadelphia Mixing Solutions mixer drives are specially designed to handle the rigors of mixing for the pulp and paper industry. With proven technologies for top entry and aeration, our total systems approach provides cost-effective solutions to maximize stock dispersion and degassing. For more information on our mixer and aeration products, contact us today at 717-832-2800 or philamixers.com.
Papier Italo Publications is introducing a new product called the Papier Italo Incubator Program. This is a long-term program that is designed to aid your company's marketing needs. Some of the objectives include increasing a company's name brand recognition, increasing an interest in a company's product and services, and more. My name is Kurt Gifford. I am the sales manager of Papier Italo Publications. For more information, I can be reached by telephone at 770-367-4823 or by email at cgifford@taii.com. We look forward to helping you with your marketing needs.
Well, now we're joined by Steve Rausch, Papier Italo's publisher and editor. Steve, what's the publication lineup for this week?
Well, Jim, on Tuesday, April 1st, and I can't believe that April Fool's Day is tomorrow, the latest Thompson Private Letter comes out. For those who may not be aware, the Thompson Private Letter is a subscription-based newsletter published monthly by Papier Italo Publications. Also on Tuesday, we have the latest edition of Paper Money coming out with more articles of business-related information on the worldwide pulp and paper industry. And then on Wednesday, we have the latest Light Green Machine Institute weekly. And, of course, on Thursday, we have another issue of Nib Impressions.
Steve, you want to tell folks how to sign up for Papier Italo Publications?
Sure, Jim. All you have to do to sign up is to go to nipimpressions.com or globalpapermoney.com and click on the To Subscribe button that's located at the top of either site. There's just a quick form to fill out with some information, and you're signed up and good to go.
All right, Steve, it's about time for the Monday morning highlight. What do we have for today?
Well, Jim, in today's morning highlight, I sat down and talked with Helen Rausch, the Vice President of Communication Sciences here at Papier Italo Publications, about a brand new program called the Papier Italo Incubator Program.
Well, thanks, Steve. We'll go to that, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Jim.
We're talking today with Helen Rausch. She's the Vice President of Communication Sciences at Papier Italo Publications. Thank you for joining us today on Pulp and Paper Radio International.
It's my pleasure.
I understand that Papier Italo Publications is launching a new program.
Yes, we are. It's called the Papier Italo Incubator Program.
Can you explain more about what that is?
The Incubator Program is a long-term marketing program that is designed to aid smaller companies with tiny marketing budgets wishing to increase their visibility in the pulp and paper industry.
So how exactly is this done?
This is a 3-year marketing program developed to systematically help increase a company's name recognition and brand awareness in the pulp and paper industry. We have stage objectives for each of the 3 years, marketing methods for each of the 3 years, and measurement that we can provide to participating companies. Year one, the objective is to increase name recognition for a company. And this would be done through 30-second spots aired on Pulp and Paper Radio International. Papier Italo Publications would provide the count of listeners on the shows, and the expectation would be at least 150 hours of listening.
So how about year two of the program?
Year two's objective is to increase a company's product and or service interest. And this would be done through a button ad on our media and a continued radio commercial that increases to weekly. Papier Italo Publications would provide the click-through data from the button ad, and the radio commercial should receive at least 200 hours of listening.
So tell me a little bit about year three.
During the third year, Papier Italo's white paper program would be utilized. a company would participate in our white paper program on NIP impressions. And Papriatello Publications would provide full details of persons that download the company's white paper. A banner ad would be placed on our appropriate media, and we would provide the click-through data the banner ad received. The weekly radio commercial would continue on Pulp and Paper Radio International with an expectation of at least 200 hours of listening.
That does sound innovative. If a company is interested in learning more about the program, what should they do?
They can either contact myself, Helen Rausch, via email at helen.rausch@taii.com. That's helen.rausch@taii.com, or by telephone at 937-403-8602. That's 937-403-8602. Or they can contact Kirk Gifford, our sales manager, at cgifford@taii.com. Again, that's cgifford@taii.com, or by telephone at 770-367-4823. Again, 770-367-4823.
Again, we've been talking today with Helen Rausch. She's the Vice President of Communication Sciences at Papriatello Publications. Thank you so much for joining us today on Pulp and Paper Radio International.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Did you know that in a typical U.S. pulp mill, it is possible to reduce your makeup chemical consumption by up to 5% and your fuel and steam cost up to 6% with minimal investment costs? For more information, give Conmark Systems Incorporated a call today at 770-300-0224. That's 770-300-0224. Or visit their website at www.conmark.com.
Bright Technologies is the leader in high-density extruders for your wet waste problems. Located in Hopkins, Michigan, USA, Bright has a solution to dewater your sludge. With hundreds of installations worldwide, Bright's extruders have a track record of proven performance and are backed by the best warranty in the industry. You can find them online at cbrightproducts.com. That's cbrightproducts.com. Or give them a call today at 269-793-7183. That's 269-793-7183.
Now we're back and we'll move on to North American news. Dateline Calhoun, Tennessee, Resolute Forest Products, Inc. announced on Thursday a $105 million U.S. dollar upgrade to its Calhoun, Tennessee pulp and paper mill, including the installation of a modern continuous pulp digester and other wood chip processing equipment. When completed by mid-2016, the project will contribute to significantly lower mill cost, increase its capacity, and improve the mill's versatility, Resolute said. In addition to creating approximately 50 new jobs to join the 480 employees currently at the mill, Resolute expects the project's implementation to produce efficiencies from better wood yield and lower steam and chemical usage. The company said it will also increase the pulp machine's production output and maximize dryer utilization for internal purposes, giving the mill the versatility to manufacture a range of products, including specialty papers and value-added grades not presently in the product offering. The Calhoun Mill currently operates three machines and a pulp dryer and has a total mill capacity of approximately 609,000 metric tons of market pulp, specialty papers, and newsprint. The Calhoun Mill has been consistently producing paper products since 1954. Dateline DeRidder, Louisiana Packaging Corporation of America announced last week that it will not convert the idle No. 2 paper machine at its DeRidder, Louisiana mill to produce containerboard. Instead, PCA will convert the No. 3 newsprint machine at DeRidder to containerboard, producing lightweight linerboard and medium, and exit the newsprint business. The No. 3 machine will continue to produce newsprint for PCA customers through mid-September 2014, at which time it will be shut down and converted to containerboard production with an anticipated startup by November 1, 2014. PCA estimated that the capital cost of converting the No. 2 machine would have been approximately $160 million U.S. dollars, and the No. 2 machine would have had an annual containerboard capacity of 300,000 tons. The cost of converting the No. 3 machine is estimated to be $115 million U.S. dollars with annual containerboard capacity of 355,000 tons. In addition, by discontinuing newsprint production, approximately 100,000 tons of low-cost virgin fiber will be available for containerboard production, thereby reducing the amount of higher-cost recycled fiber required, the company said. The shutdown of the newsprint-related assets will result in non-cash charges totaling about $30 million U.S. dollars, the company said. Dateline Chicago, Illinois, R.R. Donnelly & Sons announced last week that it has completed its acquisition of substantially all the North American operations of Esselt, a privately owned developer and manufacturer of nationally branded and private label office and stationery products. The company announced the acquisition in January in a cash and stock transaction estimated to be $96.5 million U.S. dollars. R.R. Donnelly officially said the addition of Esselt's portfolio would create a more competitive and efficient office product supplier capable of supplying enhanced offerings across the customer base. The acquisition is expected to be both deleveraging and accretive to R.R. Donnelly's earnings per share within 12 months following the closing of the transaction. The completion of the transaction is subject to customary closing conditions, including regulatory approval. Dateline Kingsley Falls, Quebec, brothers Bernard Laurent and Alain Lamare, co-founders of Cascades, and Mario Plourde, current president and chief executive officer, were on hand to celebrate Cascades' 50th anniversary on Wednesday morning at a ceremony held at the, quote, Old Mill, the company's very first facility. In the company of employees, retired workers, and partners, they commemorated 50 years of history. The ceremony marked the launch of numerous festivities which employees as well as the community are invited to attend throughout the year. At the same time, the Lamare brothers and Mario Plourde addressed employees in all 100 or so Cascade units across North America and in Europe via video, thanking them for their contribution to Cascade's success. In addition, each employee got to enjoy a small birthday cake in celebration of the 50th anniversary. I happened to be at the Greenpack Mill in Niagara Falls last Wednesday and was able to participate. The cupcakes were delicious. Congratulations, Cascades. Dateline Miami, Florida, HIG Capital LLC announced last week that it has completed the sale of its portfolio company, American Hardwood Industries, also known as AHI, to Bally Lumber. Based in Waynesboro, Virginia, AHI is a manufacturer and supplier of hardwood lumber in the United States and abroad. Founded in 1955, AHI is the largest producer in its region with over 100 million board feet of annual capacity across 11 sawmills and kiln-drying facilities in Virginia and throughout the Appalachian Territory. HIG originally invested in AHI, then known as Augusta Lumber, in 2006. We'll be back after this message. Oh, sorry about that. You know, my wife told me that if she ever heard a toilet flushing in the background again, she would hang up on me. That's a bad habit I had formed, checking into a hotel room, calling my wife, and doing other essential tasks. You know, multitasking. Hi, this is Jim Thompson here. One of our advertisers has told us they used to advertise in a certain print magazine because they always found copies of that magazine in paper mill bathrooms. We pointed out to them that if you're advertising with Papa Ritala Publications, you can be found anywhere. For instance, right on the paper machine floor. Or at the ball game. Or in the backyard on a Saturday afternoon. Or at a wild papermaker's party. Or on your nightstand right before you go to bed. Where can prospects find your advertising? If they have a phone, tablet, or computer, they can find it anywhere as long as you are advertising with Papa Ritala Publications. Go with the winner. And we're back. Dateline Montreal, media outlets are reporting that six Greenpeace activists unfurled two banners on the foremost icon in Montreal's skyline, the Mount Royal Cross, early Tuesday morning. The banners said, "Defend the Forest" and "Justice." The action stems from Greenpeace's concern with pulp and paper manufacturer Resolute Forest Products over its operations in the Boreal Forest. Resolute has its headquarters in Montreal. Greenpeace's Quebec director, Nicolas Mainville, said the banners were meant to appear as scales of justice, saying, quote, "We want to reestablish the balance between the logging practices and the protection of our public forest," end quote. Seth Kirschman, Resolute's vice president of communications, says the battle between the company and Greenpeace has continued for some time. He called last week's protest just another step in Greenpeace's outrageous, inaccurate, and deceptive allegations against Resolute. He said the Boreal Forest has plenty of protected areas that are off limits to the forest industry. Mainville, however, said Resolute's activities in the Boreal Forest in Quebec and Ontario were threatening caribou habitats and indigenous populations, and the company had lost an important environmental certification recently. Dateline York, Pennsylvania, local news outlets are reporting that Voith confirmed it is reducing its York manufacturing workforce. In April, through a combination of layoffs and early retirements, the company will have up to 90 fewer employees at its West Manchester Township plant, CEO Kevin Frank said. Voith has not announced a specific date when the layoffs will begin. Dateline East Millinocket, Maine, the Bangor Daily News reported last week that Maine lawmakers have backed off a controversial and potentially unconstitutional bill that would have forced Maine's largest provider of hydroelectric power to give a portion of its profits to the owner of Great Northern Paper Mill in East Millinocket that has been idle since January. The legislature's Energy, Utilities, and Technology Committee voted unanimously Tuesday to send a significantly watered-down version of the bill to the legislature for consideration. The original language of the bill introduced in February would have forced Brookfield Renewable Energy Partners, the mill's power provider, to pay Great Northern Paper the profits it had made from selling excess power since the mill's closure. The amended bill includes no language to force Brookfield to share its profits. It merely would encourage the two companies to reach an agreement on sharing revenue from wholesale sales of the excess power. It also calls for a one-time exemption to an existing law that otherwise would prohibit any profit sharing as long as the mill is shut down. Harold Paschios, the attorney for Brookfield Renewable Energy Partners, called the original bill a gun to the head of his client and argued that it would have been unconstitutional because it would have interfered with a contract between two private companies. He said it also would have violated the Federal Power Act, which governs the regulation of hydroelectric dams in the U.S. Great Northern Paper, a subsidiary of the New Hampshire-based private equity firm Kate Street Capital, signed a 10-year agreement with Brookfield in August 2011 to buy power for the mill in East Millinocket at a discount rate. Despite its reduced power costs, the mill's owner shut down the operation January 23 of this year, citing burdensome costs for energy and wood. In early February, it laid off 212 of the mill's 252 employees. Kate Street Capital then floated a plan to restart the mill in 4 months. Dateline Jessup, Georgia, local news outlets are reporting that attorneys for the Altamaha Riverkeeper have filed a suit against Rayonier based on the Clean Water Act. The suit says the Riverkeeper is asking that the company stop discharging chemicals into the river and that they be penalized for their actions. Rayonier's facility is located in Jessup on the banks of the Altamaha River. In the suit, the Altamaha Riverkeeper claims that Rayonier is an ongoing and continuous pollutant and alleges that Rayonier discharges 50 to 60 million gallons of polluted effluent each day. The suit has been filed in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Georgia. Rayonier says they have not officially been served but have been notified of the suit. They say that their Jessup mill operates in full compliance with its permits and its agreements with the state of Georgia and all applicable state and federal regulations. In a statement, Rayonier said in the past 5 years they've invested more than $70 million U.S. dollars to reduce the color in the water from the mill and say their efforts have reduced the color by more than 50%. The company added that it takes environmental responsibilities seriously and they intend to vigorously defend themselves against what they call a baseless lawsuit. Dateline Wisconsin, local news outlets are reporting that four paper companies and two municipalities have agreed to pay $54 million U.S. dollars to settle claims related to the discharge of PCBs into the Lower Fox River in Green Bay. The City of Appleton, CBC Coating Inc., Menasha Corporation, the Nina Menasha Sewerage Commission, U.S. Paper Mills Corporation, and WTM1 company will pay for the cleanup and damages from the chemicals which were used in carbonless copy paper decades ago. The amount is in addition to previous payments for remediation and restoration of the natural resources. One of the law firms involved in the settlement said the paper recyclers and the municipalities that treated the plant wastewater didn't know the paper contained PCBs until Appleton Coated Paper Company and NCR Corporation stopped making carbonless copy paper. The agreement would settle some claims by the federal and state governments and tribes, including the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin and the Oneida Tribe of Indians of Wisconsin. As part of the agreement, the companies and municipalities would get some protection against claims by parties that aren't part of the settlement. The agreement still needs approval of a federal court. Dateline Florida, news outlets are reporting that Klausner has received authorization to start building a sawmill located in northwestern Suwanee County, Florida. Klausner's sawmill will have a capacity of 700 million board feet, which will correspond to approximately 1.6 million cubic meters. According to local media reports, the first phases of construction have already begun, and the company expects to start operations in late July. At its Florida site, Klausner intends to create 350 permanent jobs and 700 additional jobs during the construction phase, according to reports. Turning now to personnel changes in the industry, effective immediately, Kevin Kwolinski has been appointed as President and Chief Executive Officer of Philadelphia-based Paperworks Industries, Inc. Paperworks is an operating company of Sun Capital Partners of Boca Raton, Florida. Previously, Kwolinski has spent more than 4 years as President and CEO of Portola Packaging in Batavia, Illinois. Dr. Hans-Peter Solinger, member of the Corporate Board of Management of Voith GmbH, and chairman of the management board of Voith Paper, will be leaving Voith on July 1, 2014, after serving the company for 32 years. The supervisory board and shareholders committee have appointed Bertram Staudenmeier as his successor, the company said. Then lastly, I had a nice conversation with Mark Wilde over the weekend. Mark, known as Dr. Paper in the industry's financial circles, has left Deutsche Bank in New York after 25 years. As he told me, following a 90-day, quotes, gardening sabbatical, end quotes, he will be joining BMO in their new digs on Times Square. I think it's in the new Reuters building. If you'd like to be on Mark's mailing list when that time comes, just email him at drpaper@gmail.com. That's drpaper@gmail.com. We'll be covering this in other publications, the Paparitala publications this week. Finally, today, we wrap up our show with the U.S. Pulp and Paper Facts provided by our good friends at Two Sides. Today's fact, there is a vital difference between energy production from fossil fuels and from biomass. Burning fossil fuels releases carbon dioxide that has been locked up for millions of years, introducing, quotes, new carbon, end quotes, into the atmosphere. By contrast, burning biomass simply returns to the atmosphere the carbon dioxide that was absorbed as the tree grew, and there is no net release of carbon dioxide if the cycle of growth and harvest is sustained. You can learn more at twosides.us. That's twosides.us. With that in mind, have a great week, everyone, and be safe, and thanks for listening to Pulp and Paper Radio International. And don't forget to stay around after the closing for the reading of a classic Nip Impressions column.
Thank you for listening to our show today. We appreciate your support. Make sure you're always reading the highest-ranked e-newsletters in the worldwide pulp and paper industry. That would be globalpapermoney.com and nipimpressions.com. This program has been produced by Pulp and Paper Radio International, a subsidiary of Paparitalo Publications, Duluth, Georgia, in the United States. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. And remember, whatever you do, please do it safely. We'll be talking to you soon.
Before I read the column for this week, I'll remind you, if you want to own your own copy of Raising EBITDA, The Lessons of Nip Impressions, just email me at jthompson@taii.com. The book is $45 plus shipping and handling. It is close to 700 pages in length in an 8.5 by 11-inch format. This week's column is fairly long, but I thought it was kind of interesting, and it was kind of surprising what has changed even since then. The column is titled, A Review of Office and Travel Technology and Policy Progress Since 1970. And I wrote it on the 1st of October 2007, but it's amazing, of course, and even the 7 years since then, some of the things that I called current technology in 2007 have been made obsolete as well. Progress goes on. It's a fairly long column, so sit back and relax as we go back to October of 2007. Sometimes it's good to stop and think what has been wrought over the years. I started working in a formal work setting, I am ignoring the backbreaking farm years, in 1970. There have been a few changes since then that perhaps the younger generations may have difficulty grasping. When I started working in an office, we used slide rules or just a pad and pencil. Typewriters were in use, and to make copies, the stenographers used carbonless paper and flimsies. That was thin paper used for making copies. They used an eraser wheel to make corrections, and accurate typing skills were very important as they were often typing four or five copies at a time. There was no copier in our entire company until 1971, and then it had a slot in which you fed one sheet at a time and it made one copy at a time. You could not copy books unless you tore the pages out of them and fed them into the slot in the machine. Rapid messages were sent by cable or telegraph. In order to make a long-distance call, you called the PBX, that stood for Private Branch Exchange Operator. She was effectively known as the switch, and a word that rhymes with switch and starts with B. She made the call and then hooked you to it by calling you back. All telephone equipment, even in your building, was owned by Bell. It was illegal to make a permanent link to telephone hardware, not that you had anything to link to it. By state law, females were required to take a 15-minute paid break every 2 hours for rest and rejuvenation, so plan your typing and long-distance calls carefully. I was the only one in the office that did not smoke voluntarily. Everything in the office had a thin film of cigarette tar all over it. Drawings were done in pencil on the latest and greatest thing, Mylar. I preferred vellum myself, for I thought it took pencil better, but for drawings that were going to be used repetitively, one was required to use Mylar. For other repetitive things, such as bills of materials, you had Mylar adhesive stencils that were ordered from a company in Port Washington, New York. I can't remember the name of that company. In 1973, my boss bought a Texas Instruments calculator that could add, subtract, multiply, and divide. It did not have any memory. It sold for around $159 at the time. This was when my gross weekly pay was $225. He had been the superintendent in the shop before he became our boss in engineering, but when he kicked an employee that was on the floor on all fours, the union complained, so they made him chief engineer, and thus our boss. I remember standing in the lobby one day when a female welder came in looking for a job. We were hiring at the time. The receptionist told her she should not be interested in that. It was hot and dirty work in our shop, so the woman left. About the same time, OSHA showed up for the first time and stayed a week. There were pages and pages of things they wanted to change in our office and shop. I changed jobs in 1974, and I was introduced to time-sharing computers. A computer at McDonnell Douglas in St. Louis, Missouri, held some programs we used. You called a telephone line from the office and hooked to it with an acoustic coupler. You still could not hardwire to telephone equipment. Your data had to be put in each time you ran a routine. There was no way to save your data. I also saw my first memory typewriter that year. We used it to write training manuals. When we traveled, we went to the in-house travel office where our reservations were made, and which also gave us a cash advance and, of course, our cash advance in cash, of course, for our trip. Credit cards were still a novelty. An armored truck visited this office daily to handle the cash needs. When you went to a manufacturing site from Central Engineering, as an engineer, you were expected to wear a suit no matter what the circumstances. If you made telephone calls coast to coast at this time, you had to learn how to talk on the phone. The signals were being bounced off satellites for the first time, and there was a delay and echo in the signal. You had to make sure you did not talk on top of one another, or you could get into a reverberation loop that would not end. In 1977, around Christmas, I bought my first calculator. The price of calculators had gotten low enough, and my income had risen enough that I felt I could personally afford one. Somewhere along in here, FedEx came into being. Before that, you used UPS, which was only on the ground, or the package services of Greyhound Bus Company, more likely, for they were ubiquitous, to move packages and drawings and so forth rapidly across the country. In late 1979, I bought an Apple II Plus computer for my own business. They were available with 16, 32, or 48K of RAM. I decided to go with 48K and one 5.25-inch floppy disk drive. They were not available with a hard disk. For a monitor, we used an old black and white TV, as Apple's monitors were way too expensive. We did not have a printer. They were at least $2,500 in 1979 dollars, so we made up worksheets that you filled in by hand when you solved problems. I wrote all the programs that we used in BASIC. There were no canned software programs until the next one, VisiCalc, came out. VisiCalc was the predecessor to Excel. Long-distance phone calls were running about 15 cents a minute. In 1980, I saw my first cable television in a hotel room at the Admiral Benbow Inn on the banks of the Red River in Bossier City, Louisiana. I watched CNN in fascination. In the town where I lived, we could receive two television channels, and they were talking about awarding a cable franchise. Somewhere along about this time, security screening came into use at major airports, but not at small airports. Before this, you just walked out to the gate and got on the plane. The IBM PC came out in late 1981. We bought one for our entire engineering department in the mill in which I was then working. With printer and all, it was about $8,981. The next year, word processing software became available in a program called WordStar. It took about all your fingers to hold down enough keys to create an indented paragraph. There were no mice and no Windows-style software programs. We still did not have anything like AutoCAD. That was for big applications. About this time on the mainframe in the mill, they developed the database of spare parts and cross-referenced into paper drawings in our engineering office. We had all our drawings microfilmed and put on readers and microfilm files at strategic locations throughout the mill. This was a great savings. Before this, if maintenance needed a drawing in the middle of the night, they broke into the locked drawing room and took the original to the side of the problem because they had neither the training nor the inclination to start up the blueprint machine and wait 15 minutes for it to warm up. We had often lost originals this way. Around 1985, cell phones came into use, but they were called car phones because they were permanently installed in cars since they were so large. I did not get one until about 1990, and because of permanent charges and roaming charges, my bill routinely ran $1,500 a month in 1990 dollars. I saw a fax machine for the first time in 1985. In 1987, I bought a nationwide pager. It was called a Mobira, which was a brand name of an as-yet-unheard company on the retail level, Nokia of Finland. It worked off the single sideband system of local FM radio, speaking of which, FM radio became a noticeable player on the popular music scene about 1970 or 71. Before that, popular music was all on AM. Today, I only listen to XM. When I expanded the office for a major engineering company in 1988, I decreed, quotes, no drawing boards, end quotes. We ended up with a couple just to have a place to roll out paper drawings we were still receiving from others. We spent several million dollars wiring an office for about 100 engineers with workstations, personal computers, and so forth. I had a staff of 3 technicians just to keep the whole thing running, one who worked a late shift to back up everything each night. In 1989, we started buying color monitors, and MyStar showed up on the desk of those other than the ones using drawing software. Around this time, we obtained a telephonic link to our home office on another continent so that we could transport data some way other than facsimile. This was the first office that I was in that had voicemail, which is a new thing about 1988. In 1989, I saw CNN in a hotel room in Sao Paulo, Brazil. The World Wide Web and ubiquitous email came along in 1995. I was an early adopter and have had www.taii.com up and running since then, along with my email address. In 1999, I saw CNN and watched an Atlanta Braves baseball game in a hotel room in Bogota, Colombia. In 2001, I bought a digital camera so that I could electronically send pictures. Today, I must be on my 14th or 15th cell phone. The biggest problem with them these days is they are so small you can lose them. I dropped one down a well, set on another in a creek. It was in my back pocket. The computer power in my primary office is a 2-year-old Dell driving 2 22-inch wide aspect ratio monitors plus a 7-year-old Dell driving 1 19-inch square monitor. All of this is hooked up to a Tektronix high-speed color printer. And this whole thing is hooked to a network in our home that ties together 3 more desktops and 2 laptops in a hardwired and wireless configuration. There are 2 fax scanner printer all-in-ones on the system, too. On the opposite wall in my office is a flat-screen television that is on CNBC all day, on mute. In 2004, I bought a GPS for my car, which allows me to take most direct and fastest route to appointments without thinking about it. Sometimes the best route is not intuitively obvious when just thinking about it. As you know, you can buy or often obtain free software for just about anything. For instance, I find Mozilla Thunderbird to be the best email program I've ever used, and it costs nothing. My critical files are backed up every night by Envelog for about $50 a month. And I wanted to stop and give you a side note now. Of course, I use another service today that costs about $50 a year rather than $50 a month. Back to the story. They store them in three undisclosed location computer farms scattered around the United States. With a Skype telephone and a video camera, I can call home computer to computer at no cost and with video. On the road, if I have forgotten anything, I tap back into the office system with gotomypc.com. I can do this from nearly anywhere with my broadband wireless card. Today, I do all my own word processing, calculating, book publishing, travel reservations, and shipping right from my desk. For the volume of work today, I think it would probably take one to two administrative assistants to equal productivity if we had to use the technology of 1970. I would also need another room for the rest and rejuvenation breaks if I hired female administrative assistants under the rules of those days. Moore's Law, that is, having of a computer memory cost every 18 months, is certainly alive and well. All this technology, of course, can lead to carpal tunnel, blurred vision, and other modern maladies. I also think the lifestyle of the office worker has become even more sedentary, as one does not any longer even have to get out of the chair to retrieve files. These are all safety and health issues of which we should all be aware. Be safe, and we'll talk next week. And again, that was an article or column from Nip Impressions from October 1, 2007. And the amazing thing to me is what's even changed since then. So, folks, be safe, and we'll talk to you next week.